Hi, everyone, and welcome to Climate Proofers, the show all about those on the front lines of adaptation, finance, tech, and policy. I'm Louis Woodall, the editor of Climate Proof, which you can read at www.climateproof.news. It seems everywhere you turn, there's news of another company taking a beating from climate hazards. Last year's Los Angeles wildfires took huge lumps out of insurers, including Allstate and State Farm. Also in 2025, severe storms loaded burdensome recovery costs onto the utilities CenterPoint Energy and CMS Energy Corporations, among others. Even chocolate makers are struggling. Last summer, Mondelez International, which owns chocolate snack brands Cadbury, Oreo, Milka, and Toblerone, reported a slump in sales volumes due to a heatwave in Europe. Faced with mounting climate risks, you'd think corporates would be racing to put bold, well-thought-out adaptation plans out into the world to reassure investors. Recent analysis, though, suggests this isn't the case. Today, I'm joined for the second time by Dr. Paul Munday, a director at S&P Global Ratings and the company's Global Adaptation and Resilience Specialist. He returns to the pod to share the findings of his latest research on corporate adaptation plans, research that shows while there has been an increase in adaptation plan disclosure, big gaps still remain, especially on adaptation targets, monitoring frameworks, and metrics for tracking progress. We also get into why it is that despite rising climate risks, credit rating agencies are yet to take actions on vulnerable companies. Notably, S&P itself has not yet taken a rating action on a European corporate based on physical risk, so far at least. This all makes for a chunky interview with plenty to engage all you adaptation heads out there. I trust you find it as enlightening as I did. Before we get started, a little update on March's membership drive. A big thank you to all those who upgraded to become paying members last month. We're now at 269 members, short of our 300-member target, but not by too much. So you can help us get there this month by upgrading at www.climateproof.news/upgrade, which will give you access to additional in-depth features, data dashboards, and more. Okay, in a minute, my conversation with Paul, but first a roundup of last week's top adaptation and resilience stories. In finance, the Green Climate Fund approved $960 million for adaptation and mitigation projects, pushing its total portfolio past $20 billion. The world's largest dedicated climate fund said nearly half of the money, $441 million, would flow to Africa, headlined by a $250 million World Bank program to expand resilient energy access across 21 countries in eastern and southern Africa. 8 of the 18 greenlit projects are adaptation only, with the adaptation share representing 56% in grant equivalent terms. These include an effort to strengthen Chad's adaptation of land, ecosystems, and smallholder farmers, a climate risk protection shield for Zambia bringing better insurance to 140,000 farming households, and an initiative to strengthen the climate resilience of the Peruvian Amazon, backed by the World Wildlife Fund. In policy, the US Forest Service will shutter 57 research stations under a reorganization plan published last week, likely undermining the agency's work to monitor climate-driven threats to the nation's forests. Under the plan, the agency's research division will be consolidated at a new headquarters in Fort Collins, Colorado, with field researchers shuffled to other state offices. The Forest Service's headquarters will also move to Salt Lake City in Utah from Washington. The shakeup could hobble efforts to understand how wildfires, invasive species, droughts, and other climate-driven hazards affect important natural ecosystems, the New York Times reports. Several current agency employees who spoke to the Times said they expected many colleagues would rather leave the agency than switch jobs or relocate. And in tech, agricultural technology startups have a new champion in the Climate Emergencies Resilience Lab, a new program supporting adaptive crop solutions. Set up by venture creator Deep Science Ventures and nonprofit Renaissance Philanthropy, the lab is backing three technical pillars in agtech. 1. Forecasted biological priming. 2. Environment-responsive protectants. And 3. Rapid breeding tools. The partners argue that genetic engineering for crop resilience is approaching its limits and want to push the agtech field in a different direction. Right, that's it for this week's news roundup. Now onto my conversation with Paul. Hi, Paul. Where are you calling from today and what do you do?
Hey, Louis. I'm calling from London and I'm the Global Adaptation and Resilience Specialist at S&P Global Ratings.
Now, you should be no stranger to old hands, to climate proofers. You were one of my first guests, actually, back in 2024. And we spoke back then about this pioneering research you had done with your team on corporate adaptation plans. That was called Risky Business. Good title for a report. And now you come back with a new report called Mercury Rising.
So I want to know a little bit about what's changed in that 2.5 year period since the first analysis, why you've done this analysis again, and what we can learn about the progress corporates have made on adaptation planning over the last few years. So going back to Risky Business, that was an analysis of corporate adaptation plans, which found only 20% of companies had these plans in place and few had near-term implementation timelines. From my memory, most companies that had adaptation plans were kind of looking out beyond the 10-year horizon for actually doing something to deal with climate physical risk. Now, with Mercury Rising, you are using a different data set and you're using a slightly different analysis. Can you tell us what the latest report tells us about the progress made or not made on adaptation planning?
Yeah, sure. So we did that report a couple of years ago now, and really, the idea then was to do a kind of a global study looking at how corporates are making progress or not on adaptation. And you're right, it was actually about 21% of companies, of about 6,500 companies, and from memory, that had disclosed an adaptation plan. And as you say, varying amounts of kind of intention to deliver kind of implementation of those plans over time. And there, of course, were sectoral differences. We've kind of leveraged some of the same data sets. So the kind of corporate sustainability assessment, the CSA, which is kind of hosted by another division of S&P. And we have seen through that kind of 2025 reporting that the number of disclosures has almost doubled. So it's about 43%, depending on how you kind of cut the population now, versus that kind of 21%. So the number of disclosures has increased. Now, that's since 2022, that's about 21%. 2024 was about 35%, and so now 43%. So it has gone up. One of the purposes of this report was not only to kind of look at the amount of responses to that type of survey, but also to kind of go in to understand a bit more about the quality, if you like, of those plans. You know, what kind of components of adaptation planning are companies really doing? And by that, I mean, are they leveraging kind of multiple climate scenarios and time points in their climate risk analysis? What type of qualitative or quantitative physical risk assessment are they doing? And by that, I mean, are they using kind of asset level up information, or are they doing, you know, stakeholder-led consultations or something else? And then also, are they setting metrics and targets for adaptation? Are they costing the measures that are needed? Are they capturing those costs in their financial plan? So that was really what we were trying to do with this piece, to try and say, okay, well, we think there's progress being made on adaptation, which clearly with the number of disclosures going up, there probably is. But how precisely is that being achieved? And we decided really on this piece to kind of focus on European corporates. And one of the reasons for that, as well as, is because we know that based on that Risky Business research, European corporates seem to have been making more progress vis-a-vis other global regions. So it seemed like a natural place to start. And also, we decided to focus on some of the kind of better rated, i.e. those investment grade companies that we rate, i.e. so we can look at kind of, in inverted commas, the best companies in Europe, and just try and understand how they as a group are making progress in adaptation. I can tell you some of the findings from that kind of analysis.
Absolutely. I want to get into that, but maybe just first, like, why do you think, what drivers mean that European corporates are moving ahead on adaptation planning?
Good question. So I think one of the findings from Risky Business that I think still holds true is that where there are, you know, stronger or more strict environmental legislation and disclosure, that tended to increase the proportion of disclosures within global regions. So Europe was particularly kind of strong in that regard. I think also we kind of found in that piece as well that larger companies tended also to be making more progress. And I think we determined in that piece that was probably because they had more resources to kind of throw at the problem, both, you know, financial and also kind of human resources as well. And also, I think many of those companies in Europe had also had historic experience of physical risks. And I think where awareness that the climate literature is quite clear that entities have experience of the impacts from physical risk and climate shocks, they tend to have made more progress to kind of addressing those exposures. So that was really kind of the main driver in selecting that kind of group of European corporates.
So I'd like to drill down into some of the more granular data points you found from the Mercury Rising report. But first of all, I appreciate the focus on quality of disclosures rather than just kind of quantity. And I think I found, and I'm sure you've seen as well, like, there are increased indications of companies using the right magic words like adaptation or resilience in their reports, talking about physical risk. There's some understanding from the dissemination from the policy world that corporates have to get on bored with this, but that doesn't translate to actually these reports, these disclosures being useful. So can you tell us a little bit about what you're looking for now that you think is an indication of a good quality adaptation report? Like, what are the metrics, the particular statements, the particular disclosures that you're looking for?
That hasn't really changed since the Risky Business Report. So in that report, we kind of outlined a number of components, i.e. features of adaptation plans that we would look for. So I mentioned just about whether an entity is using multiple climate scenarios, time points, whether they've identified the adaptation measures that may be needed, they've costed those measures, they've incorporated them into their financial plans, whether they set metrics and targets for adaptation, whether they've got a monitoring and evaluation framework in place, et cetera. All of those things in combination, i.e. if an entity is able to demonstrate more of those components, that would be indicative, in our view, of an entity that's more likely to kind of ride out some of these shocks and recover from shocks should they materialize. Now, that's, I should say that those kind of components that I just described, that's not something that we've necessarily kind of come up with. There's quite a bit of literature in this space that describes the types of things to look for in kind of adaptation plans. So there's ISO guidance for companies, so ISO 14090. There's a separate piece looking specifically at climate risk assessment, so 14091, you can look it up. And there's a separate version for governments and local communities, 14,092. And there's also been some...
That just came out recently.
Yeah, exactly. And there's also some other guidance that have been released for corporates specifically. So the WBCSD's guidance that released in 2025, which also kind of sets some guardrails around the types of things to include. So they're really kind of baked into those types of standards, codes and guidance that are otherwise kind of available. And I think I would say that there is a kind of an emerging consensus. If you look at that literature around what you typically look for, and those are the things that I've mentioned, but there also is a kind of disaggregation between the components that are probably, I guess, more advanced, you could say, than others, and it takes a bit more effort and thought to deliver on them. So developing metrics and targets, for example, for adaptation, we know is really difficult, and indeed, to be able to kind of identify those metrics and targets where they are in place and to be able to compare them across assets or project types is very challenging, and equally to develop monitoring and evaluation frameworks for adaptation, which is why in this report we found that none of the companies in our 70 or so sample were able to demonstrate those components. So none of them showed that there's more kind of advanced components of adaptation plan analyses. And actually, I think the reality is for this group of 70 of European investment grade corporates and also kind of companies more generally, they seem to be at the stage of kind of having done a kind of a physical risk assessment. Some have taken that forward in costed measures. Very few have taken it forward and integrated those costs into their financial plans, which of course would be credit relevant. And very, very few, if any, have developed metrics and targets, et cetera, as I've described. So I think it's important when we're talking about the adaptation investments that might be required to actually level set a little bit and just say, look, this is probably where most companies are, having done that assessment of physical risk and to understand what's most material to their operations.
Yes, I think there needs to be a frank conversation about the marginal value of increasingly complex or in-depth adaptation planning for certain corporates, right? If there's not a regulatory stick, what is the impetus for companies to disclose more and more about their adaptation planning? It could be because, yes, it could help protect revenue or avoid losses down the line. Perhaps it could help inform future revenue opportunities or business lines. Or it may be that the sector to which the company belongs is just known to be more vulnerable to climate risk, and investors and stakeholders will just be looking for some evidence that, okay, yeah, you've done a physical risk assessment, but we know you're vulnerable anyway, so can you tell us what you're actually doing? And this comes to some of this kind of sectoral analysis you did. I note from the Mercury Rising report that it was chemicals companies and consumer products companies that seem to be above average in terms of their adaptation preparedness. So can you explain why you think that is, and what patterns are you picking up that explains why some sectors are leading, some sectors are lagging?
Yeah, no, good question. And I would say as well, just in response to your kind of previous point, I think that many companies don't know that they're doing adaptation. I think adaptation is a kind of a term as well, and this has been discussed, I think, in other forums. It's kind of a bit of an IPCC type term, and it might not be a familiar type of term for many companies, even though they're doing adaptation. So, you know, we can think about adaptation as companies that are working on improving water resilience or, you know, water quality, or looking at smart agriculture, or providing kind of tools and services and products that identify exposures to physical risks. I think a lot of entities don't realize they're doing that, which is why these kind of disclosure standards like CSRD and others that are kind of encouraging companies to improve the kind of quality of their disclosures on adaptation are really kind of forcing their hands to think about and contextualize what they're doing in the context of adaptation action. In the context of your other question around sectoral kind of differences, yeah, there are some differences. And I think we've, in this Mercury Rising report, just on European corporates, and also in another piece we did, Ripple Effect, that was looking at the exposures that sectors inherit from physical risks, we really found that it was those companies in sectors that have direct exposure to physical risks tended to have been making more progress and tend to have been having kind of more awareness and to have plans and rather to have shorter implementation timelines. And, you know, chemicals is probably a good example in the context of those types of companies, you know, really having stronger kind of outsized exposure to kind of water supply issues. And therefore, you know, they're in many ways have been kind of forced to take action and or have been seen historical kind of impact. So the short answer is where there's direct exposure, I think that's driving some of the kind of greatest sectoral differences. I mentioned also earlier about kind of larger companies. That definitely seems to be a common theme in our analysis, again, as well as those that are investment grade that we found in our risky business piece. I think also there seems to be kind of emerging evidence as well that, you know, companies are making kind of more progress where there's maybe kind of greater scrutiny of their operations. So, you know, larger companies particularly may be taking action to try and reduce, you know, and avoid reputational risks as well. So it's a bit of a hedge against those sorts of things. So it's still like, you know, the essence of adaptation, it kind of matters what you are and where you are. So there's absolutely variation within sector and by company and across assets as well. But generally speaking, we did find that chemicals companies, real estate, et cetera, seem to be making a bit more progress.
Yes, I wanted to dig in on what might be a divergence, though, in practices. And I'm glad you mentioned the real estate sector because your research shows that they had the highest disclosure rate, but are actually the least likely to take action within the next decade, with only 19% of real estate companies targeting implementation in the next 10 years. So this is quite an interesting divergence for me, is that, yes, you might say greater disclosure, but if that disclosure is not actually pointing to tangible actions that take place in the near term, does that suggest that these companies are kind of like going through the motions and they've not put real thought into financing adaptation, actually implementing adaptation? Is that a kind of divide we're starting to see now between people who can say the right things and say the right things in quantity and actually saying the things that show tangible action is going to be taken in the short term?
Yeah, so I think the real estate example is quite interesting because I think you're right, 19% say that they will implement within 10 years. Now that compares to about 29% across about 1,400 or so companies. So there seems to be a bit of a difference. Now, we don't go into the weeds to understand why that might be the case. There could be, of course, nuance on a company basis, i.e. they're not seeing those kind of exposures, those impacts play out at the moment. It's the kind of global data set, which is picking up maybe entities with assets that are in coastal locations, for example. So that could be explaining some of it. For, you know, real estate, the big focus, you know, in the last few years, of course, has really been on transition related risk and trying to reduce emissions and to improve those kind of credentials. So I think adaptation and resilience has always been a part of that, but it's probably played second fiddle in some cases. So yeah, we need to look into a bit more depth, I think, to understand precisely what's going on there.
My mind can't help going towards the AI and data center theme, right? Where you have these grand announcements of we're going to spend $80 billion over the next 10 years to do X, Y, and Z, right? And it's like, oh, that's a big number. That's exciting. And a company might say, yes, we have a comprehensive adaptation plan, which means in 15 years' time, we will be X, Y, Z, you know? And there's a question for me whether that is evidence of companies understanding the need to wink, nudge, nudge the market on adaptation, but maybe not putting in place the actual necessary planning and infrastructure to go ahead and implement. And we've seen in the last few months a number of these, like, billion-dollar investments in AI kind of like be quietly shift to the side. And I wondered the same thing could happen with adaptation.
Well, I think, look, I mean, I can't speak for kind of decisions that companies make, but I think that, you know, the reality at the moment as well, you know, companies are making decisions at the same time that there are many competing objectives around supply chain issues and geopolitics, et cetera. So, and many of those are kind of a more immediate, or rather are viewed to be a more immediate threat to their operations and are causing immediate disruption. So, you know, invariably companies have to make decisions that may mean that, you know, the impacts from physical risk can be pushed out a bit further. But I think it's certainly in the, you know, the conversations that I'm having and with others in this space, and probably that you're having as well, that it seems that the physical risks are here to stay, and adaptation is increasingly being seen as an opportunity to try and build resilience to these kind of worsening climate shocks.
Okay, I want to turn now to what physical risk exposure and adaptation planning can actually mean tangibly to these investment grade companies and other companies that are kind of issuing debt into the market, because I note in the report that S&P Global has yet to take a rating action on a European corporate driven by physical climate risk. And over here in the States, this has become kind of a live issue because there's a sense of disbelief almost that certain exposed municipalities or corporates haven't actually seen a big rating downgrade in spite of what appears to be really debilitating vulnerability to climate-driven extremes. And there's this great example of Corpus Christi, a municipality in Texas over here, which is going through a severe water crisis. And there's been a lot of discussions and papers written about, okay, well, what does this mean for Corpus Christi's municipal rating? What does it mean for the corporates sort of based in Corpus Christi? And I actually had a conversation with somebody in the rating industry about this, and I learned a lot about how the exposure to a climate emergency can actually be ameliorated, at least in the short term, by kind of fast implement sticking plaster solutions. So in the case of Corpus Christi, there are rules that allow corporates to kind of drill for their own water if they need to, or there's the capability to bring in kind of mobile desalination plants if necessary, right? So these are kind of short-term fixes, which you might not think are good for the long term, but actually from a credit point of view, might actually prevent the creditworthiness of a municipality or corporate that's facing water scarcity from taking a hit in terms of seeing their rating go down. So that's just an interesting story that I think kind of highlights the discrepancy between popular perceptions of climate risk and actually what it means for credit. And I wonder if you could like share your views on this tension and get into why physical risk may not be showing up in credit ratings yet.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a question I get a lot. I'm not a credit analyst, I should say, so I maybe should say that in my intro. I sit in a research team, but I work with credit analysts and also our sustainable finance analysts as a subject matter expert, effectively, to try and bring greater clarity to how we think about physical risk and adaptation in the context of our credit analysis, but also our second party opinions. You know, that said, I can kind of speak to this topic. And I should say, just to kind of a slight correction to your question, ratings actions, you know, due to physical risks, they do remain limited. And we did a piece late last year, I think it was, that looked across all of our rated universes globally, all sectors. And we found about 1% of all ratings were due to physical risks. And there are, of course, kind of sectors and geographies that kind of receive more of those. So, you know, that's across corporates, infrastructure, financial services, and US public finance. So there are actions due to physical risk that are taking place. But in our analysis here of European corporates, you know, we have, just as some examples, we have made previously some revisions, or rather a revision to a rating outlook of a port operator in kind of LATAM. That was due to kind of steep drops in kind of volumes due to climate events. We've changed the outlook on an above rail operator out in Australasia a few years ago, again, due to kind of more frequent physical risks being one of those factors. And then also back in 2021, if you can remember back that far, Winter Storm Uri, and there was also kind of pervasive drought conditions in California that led to a kind of a widespread group of rating actions, largely in our kind of energy and utility subsectors of corporates and US public finance. So the point I'm trying to make is we have taken those actions in certain asset classes and in certain geographies where we have visibility of kind of impacts. But so far in this kind of European corporate context, it hasn't been the case. And, you know, I would also kind of say that, you know, we've credit ratings, not climate ratings. There are many moving parts to a credit rating. It may be that companies have a particular amount of headroom or liquidity. They've got insurance. They may have other financial resources to try and ride out many of these shocks that otherwise would lead to, or could lead rather, to an impact on credit worthiness. So we look at, as part of our credit rating processes, the exposure to climate hazards of entities. We kind of weigh up what companies are kind of doing about this in the context of their long-term adaptation plans and how that kind of weighs on their credit fundamentals. And, you know, of course, in many cases, reality is that those kind of adaptation investments can require quite large upfront capex, which ultimately can weigh on credit quality. But there are opportunities from these types of investments, and many companies already benefiting from doing adaptation. And I mentioned some of the examples earlier around kind of water resilience and sort of supply type issues, and around smart agriculture, etc. So yeah, there are demonstrable returns on investment for adaptation, but it becomes more of a challenge in some of these kind of larger kind of capex heavy fixed asset type investments, which has to be weighed against all of the other fundamentals in our credit analysis.
I feel there's a tension between those of us in the climate space who know that climate change is driving more frequent and intense extreme weather events. We know that exposure is greater because we're building houses and our supply chains are kind of spreading into high-risk areas. And I suppose there's sometimes a desire amongst these circles for rated agencies to take more drastic action to reflect real physical risk and growing physical risk, because that will send the signal to the market that, oh goodness, we actually have to price this properly. And there's plenty of debates about whether climate risk has been priced correctly or not in financial markets. And that debate's never going to end. But having spoken to professionals at rating agencies and taking into account that you're not on the rating side, it is clear that there are so many different factors and influences that go into a rating decision. There are so many reasons why a company may be facing a lot of climate risk, but is still actually, from a credit perspective, seen as pretty rosy because actually they have implemented adaptation actions. I think there's still, despite this being like 10, 15 years on from the beginning of kind of a climate and financial institution and climate and corporate kind of movement, there's still a hope or sense that maybe rating agencies should be a bit more activists, and they're the ones who will actually be the kind of pioneers who help drive this massive reprice.
Well, I don't think that's necessarily the responsibility of credit rating agencies. We produce credit ratings, against a set of publicly available methodologies and criteria, and they combine and bring together a number of different types of analyses and data points. And look, where we have visibility and certainty about the returns on investment of these types of measures, but also, knowing where, how and when those types of impacts can play out and actually what that's going to cost. If you've got certainty, that's in the analysis. The reality for physical risks, and adaptation, like I mentioned in this report around our kind of progress that we're seeing amongst this group, is that those data points aren't necessarily available. And the disclosure requirements are and will likely help to improve the transparency of those types of data points. And of course, those would be, leveraged by the likes of us and other financial market participants. But I think the reality is there is still quite a lot of uncertainty about precisely, the exposures, how they're going to materialize, how they're going to crystallize, where and when, how, what the impacts might be, what they might cost, what the success of those adaptation measures might be, and also those returns in some cases, like I mentioned. So, solving that piece and providing the data that supports, better transparency and analysis of those aspects absolutely would be beneficial in the context of a financial analysis.
Okay, and sticking with the financial world, to finish off, can you explain what investors that want to step up their adaptation and engagement efforts, what should they be asking corporates to do and report? Do you think investors should use adaptation planning information to inform their allocation decisions?
Good question. So, I can't advise investors on what they should do. I can't be influencing capital flows. That's a big no.
But I can.
Nor do I know. But no, I think there is, as I mentioned earlier, there is kind of guidance that exists and codes and standards around, what you may expect to see in the context of an adaptation plan. And I mentioned the ISO guidance, the kind of BSI, Risk Standards Institute, and also other kind of emerging kind of industry standards and guidance that's available. And that can help you ask kind of questions about what those plans should contain. But fundamentally, really, you're asking kind of two things, what are you exposed to and what are you doing about it? And of course, how much is that going to cost? That's really what it boils down to. And we can get into metrics and targets and all those nuances, but really those are the two things. What you're exposed to most materially, what are you doing about it? Typically, when we have kind of interactions with management teams and ministers of finance and those sorts of things, that's really kind of what it boils down to. And it's, I should say also, it's pretty clear that we can't protect everything from kind of worsening climate hazards. There needs to be a more kind of pragmatic approach. And, you know, there are limits to adaptation in terms of the finances and resources that you can throw at the problem as well. And therefore, kind of prioritization is key. And I think, you know, one way to kind of help with that, I mean, we talk about climate data and the proliferation of kind of climate information that's, you know, emerged, particularly over the last kind of 5 years or so. And really that kind of exposure data is a great kind of foundation for understanding, you know, where climate hazards are at the moment, where they're expected to kind of worsen, where those areas of kind of concentrated exposure, outsized exposure might be. And therefore, you know, that can help you think about where you might want to kind of prioritize those investments, like where those kind of opportunities might be, where the demand for adaptation kind of tools, services, products, et cetera, might be. And that's kind of one way that I've been hearing, you know, and seeing in conversations with folk about how to kind of view this kind of adaptation piece as a potential opportunity, prioritizing kind of where things are likely to get worse and focusing effort there.
Yes, I do think we're at the start of a regime shift where we're going to start taking physical risk data and especially forecast data more seriously and incorporating them more regularly into corporate planning and financial institution decision making. Like, we do that with expectations of what central banks are going to do with interest rates, right? And I imagine, like, it seems so natural now, but there must have been a time where only a few companies were actually doing that. And, you know, some companies are doing it with greater sophistication than others. And now it's kind of automatic. You see the repricing happening instantly as soon as decisions on interest rates change. And I'm wondering whether we're nearly at that point because of the advances in data collection, because of the advances in modeling, we're going to start treating physical risk data as highly credible and highly valuable for decision making. And that's when we'll start seeing a more interesting divergence in pricing of climate risk across companies and across jurisdictions. That's my hope. I might be wrong, but I do feel like reports like yours and data like yours is showing that's the case.
It could be. I mean, I think that, you know, we've talked already about the kind of disclosure piece and, you know, the kind of EU CSRD, you know, we view it could improve the quality of companies' adaptation resilience plans. You know, companies are kind of looking at delivering, disclosing more consistent kind of audited metrics for climate risk and resilience. And of course, you know, as a result, that's helpful on a comparison basis. But also we've, you know, seen a stepping back in some instances of kind of sustainability reporting rules. And that's meaning that many fewer companies are being brought into that process. And that's also a challenge, because I think those disclosures can, of course, be quite helpful, particularly, you know, in our analysis and other folks' analysis as well. I mean, that said, I do still think that the kind of disclosures standards like the Global Reporting Initiative, the GRI, will probably still be quite important. You know, investors are always seeking kind of more information, more data, being able to compare off entities and kind of what they're doing about physical risks. So I think that kind of rollback, I still think there's likely to be kind of a push to improve those disclosures, the extent to which they're useful. Hopefully our kind of report here has gone some way into trying to kind of allude to the quality of those disclosures and the type of information that might be available. And I think it's quite clear that progress is being made, but in many cases, it's kind of nascent for most sectors.
And yes, there's definitely been a proliferation of analysis of adaptation plans, right? You're not the only acronym-heavy company to be doing this. MSCI came out with an interesting report looking at companies in the developed and developing worlds and what they're doing on adaptation, but also where they could show revenue-generating opportunities from selling adaptation goods and services. They use a different analysis to you. I've even been able to vibe code my own analysis of 10K reports and earnings calls now, and I think it's great that we have lots of different ways to approach this and get data without actually having to have it in structured format. But I do agree the disclosures help because then you have a framework in which to kind of operationalize data instead of being like, oh, this data point is interesting, this data point is interesting, and kind of hobbling something together that might actually not provide something useful to you as an investor. But I do think we're going to see a greater volume of research analysis of adaptation plans going forward, which I welcome because I'm a content guy and I need more stuff to write about in this space. But I do turn to folks like you, Paul, because you've been in this area for a long time and the analysis you and the team put together is of a very high quality, very high detail. And just to finish off, can I ask what we can expect from you and the team for the rest of the year on the adaptation front?
Good question. Thanks for the opportunity for coming on. I want to say much of the same, but by that I mean, you know, more kind of analysis or progress on adaptation, you know, deeper dives across asset classes and geographies, but also continuing the kind of theme that I've developed over the years of kind of deep dives into sectors, and particularly with a focus on those sectors that are kind of more sensitive to physical risks. So yeah, more to come. Got a lot to do, but yeah, we'll continue putting this out there, and hopefully you and the audience find it useful.
Yes, you're the good type of busy, just like me, I find. And it's great that we've got so much to get our teeth into, and people seem to want it as well. So I encourage all my listeners to keep following what Paul and the team is doing. I'll have a link to your LinkedIn profile in the show notes so people can keep track of you themselves. Paul, always great to have you on. Look forward to talking to you again soon. But for now, thank you and have a great rest of your week.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Climate Proofers is a Climate Proof Media production. It is produced and presented by me, Louis Woodall. Subscribe to the Climate Proof newsletter by going to climateproof.news/subscribe. And to learn more about the publication, feel free to reach out directly using our LinkedIn page. Goodbye for now.